Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And very pleased to say we have a guest on the show today, which is Dawn McAvoy. How are you, Dawn?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
It's really exciting to have you on the show. Could you explain a little bit about who you are, Dawn, what you do?
Yeah, I lead an initiative called Both Lives, which is all about both lives and pregnancy. And that's a UK-wide initiative for the Evangelical Alliance. It started in 2017 in Northern Ireland and was a campaign primarily addressing the proposed law changes here in Northern Ireland to abortion law. And we were called Both Lives Matter. And we were co-founded with the Evangelical Alliance. Then obviously the law for Northern Ireland changed in 2020. And in 2024, after the sort of the strange COVID pause that everybody experienced, then we relaunched and with a fresh branding. This is our first birthday. It was probably this time last year with the Evangelical Alliance and UK-wide.
And for those of us, those listening who aren't from the UK, could you explain a little bit about the Evangelical Alliance? What is that?
We are, the Evangelical Alliance is worldwide. And in the UK, we've been around since 1846. It's the largest unity evangelical alliance in the world. So we represent individuals, organizations, and churches who are members. And it's all about church unity and also advocacy for the church, to media and government, and from the church as well.
Brilliant. All right. Well, it's great to have you on the show. And in particular, because you are yourself, I believe, a Matters of Life and Death listener.
I am indeed. So I was looking forward to meeting. I have met John before a couple of times, but I'd never met you. So I was looking forward. And when I'm listening and you're sort of just chatting away, I was like, oh, I'd love to be part of that.
Well, we're really pleased to be able to invite you into the conversation because you had some very interesting responses to our podcast that we did. Was it a couple of months ago now, at some point in November or December, I can't remember. I'll put a link in the podcast notes. Me and Dad had a conversation about contraception. Would you want to explain a little bit about what you thought of what we said and what kind of prompted you wanting to kind of push back a little bit on some of the things that we were discussing?
Yeah, as you said, I do listen regularly, and without sort of blowing sunshine, I've always valued very much what your dad, John, brings to the conversation for everything to do with medical ethics and an Orthodox Christian faith and understanding. So I was delighted, actually, when I saw the subject matter. It's something as both lives we've been talking about and wondering how we enter into the conversation more recently. And there's been a lot more talk in the media even recently. So anyway, I listened to the podcast and then I emailed you both and John, because I said I've always valued very much what I've learned and heard. And this was the first time I think I said that I came away with more questions than maybe answers. And I wanted to check what I had understood or misunderstood and maybe, yes, push back in a couple of ways respectfully. But yes, I wanted to ask a few questions rather than, as I said, grumble in the corner.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm well aware that contraception is one of those difficult and controversial issues, particularly for many Christians. I suspect that people without faith perhaps are less troubled by it, although, you know, we can discuss that a bit. But I quite often go around and give talks in churches and other Christian venues. And in the Q&A, contraceptive issues are very common. So it is clearly an issue which many people are concerned about, and I think as we did discuss in the podcast, part of the problem is that the science and the precise mechanisms of action of many of the contraceptives is not very well established, and there are serious uncertainties, and then it's a question of trying to navigate those uncertainties and trying to work out what is an appropriate and a godly response to that.
Yeah, and I think sort of as a woman of a certain age now, I'm past sort of having my own children, but I remember, I had a crisis pregnancy or a pregnancy crisis myself when I was at university, and then post that, it was very much a conversation within our marriage about having children, when we would stop having children, at what point, and how we would prevent having more children than we wanted. We'd had all three of our children by the time I was 25, nearly 26. So there were many years of fertileness ahead of me that I had to think about. And I can remember arguing with a healthcare professional about a method of contraception that I believed did more than I was being told, and coming away at that point thinking information is key, accurate information upon which you make your own personal decisions. So thinking, why am I not being given all the information? What choices are out there? How do I do this for the next 30 years in line with my value base and Christian faith? And that is still the case. You know, we might have more choice in some ways, but actually when it all hinges and when you believe life begins, maybe the choice isn't as great as you would like to think it is. And yet it's so important for you as a couple and as a family.
And it's always regrettable, isn't it, how much this conversation seems to fall disproportionately on women. And that I know that, you know, you had a conversation with your husband, but I think for a lot of women is a sense in which this is their kind of burden to shoulder alone, and they are responsible for ensuring that they don't become pregnant, and they have to work through the ethics and the science and their bodies and the hormones and everything else to figure out this kind of maze. And it doesn't feel like it's a shared burden very often between couples. Do you think that's right?
I think that is right. And you know, we don't want to sort of see life through rose-tinted spectacles. You know, so much of what I'm saying, I think, depends on circumstances where women are supported, where women are enabled in their pregnancy and birth and parenting. Ideally, we have stable, secure foundations upon which we build our families, and too often that's not the case. And we always say when we're doing a talk anywhere that it takes a man and a woman to make a baby, and ideally it takes a man and a woman to raise a baby, and too many women are left on their own because too many men don't take responsibility. So again, whenever you have an understanding, a very clear understanding of when life begins, and then you are motivated by supporting that life, it drives all the subsequent decisions that you take about relationships and sex. And certainly when it comes to hormonal contraceptives, and maybe the more recent rise in the understanding around, or the support for more understanding and an increased uptake of fertility awareness-based methods, that would be something that I would be very interested in, because actually it's primarily a joint decision making course of action, but more than that, actually I think in the bigger context where women are so often at war with their own bodies, I think it brings an empowerment, actually, our understanding of what it means to be a woman, what our monthly cycle is, what fertility is, how our biology works. And to me, more information actually is a good thing when it comes to the decisions that we take as an individual, but also then as a couple.
So it's very interesting to me, you know, just to get to look back in the history. You know, back in the 1960s, really at the time of the sexual revolution, the hormonal contraceptive pill was heralded as a massive advance for women's interests. You know, for the first time, she wasn't dependent on these terrible men to act responsibly. She could take control over her own fertility and could be liberated from the burden, you know, of her fertility. So the way it was presented then was immensely positive, and it was presented as being a pro-woman initiative. But now, you know, what are we, 60 years later, it looks rather different. And it's not just people, with the Christians, with a very high view of protecting the embryo, is it? There's a general move amongst young women against hormonal contraception.
Yeah, and certainly sort of cards on the table. I never took hormonal contraceptives myself. I always was wary of, as I said, it was going to be sort of 30 years worth after I had my own children of potentially being mindful of not getting pregnant and having more children. So I didn't want to take hormones for that length of time. And talking to friends who did, hearing about side effects, and that awareness has only increased. So I suppose it's hard. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. Do you know, going back to a previous generation, it's hard to imagine that era where women were so much more restricted in the context of education, social freedoms, the workplace. When you were married and had children, you maybe couldn't continue to work. And it's not that long ago. I've a friend who's maybe just 10 years older, 15 years older than me, who had to leave her job when she got married. Do you know? So, I mean, that's quite shocking. So I suppose, you know, the era of being able to control your fertility and the initiation of sort of women's rights being tied into controlling your fertility seemed very positive, and it ushered in many positive aspects. But I think there's certainly a really interesting conversation in secular as well as faith spaces about the harms of the sexual revolution for women, the harms of hormonal contraceptives for women and relationships. So I think it deserves consideration, not in the sense of judging decisions in the past, but just with 60 years of data and experience to go on.
I find this very interesting because, as far as I'm aware, the side effects from hormone contraception have kind of always been there. In fact, if anything, they were slightly worse in the early days, because I think they put the dosage a bit too high before they realised you could have the same effect with the lower levels of the hormones. And yet, you struggle to find much kind of pushback in the kind of popular culture when you read stuff from the 60s and 70s from women saying, hold on, these pills are quite hard to take. They have take quite a toll on my body. And whereas, as you say today, I mean, I think we mentioned this in the episode, but it's certainly the case, isn't it, that women of faith and without faith are massively more aware and I think more sceptical about the side effects of hormonal contraception. Do you think that, is that because if the side effects have been the same throughout, or if anything were worse in the early days, do you think women were more prepared to tolerate them in the 60s because it felt they kind of knew what they had recently been kind of liberated from, whereas today people take for granted that they'll be able to control their fertility, and so the idea of doing it via the pill seems kind of less tolerable?
Possibly. I also think maybe the context of individual use was different. When it was first introduced, it was primarily for married women and you were older. Now, younger women and girls, you know, you can start taking the hormonal pill in your teens. Yeah. So you're probably on them for much longer. And then there's also, I think, just a wider, maybe understanding of wanting to be healthy and well-being, the well-being that you want to have. And as you say, when it's not sort of measured against an era of oppression or patriarchy, maybe that you think you want to come out of, you're measuring it against a different value base. So I think, and you have those stories, you know, you've more the proportion of women taking them. And so certainly even just sort of anecdotally asking peers, family members and younger colleagues to ask sort of in their friendship groups, there is definitely a hesitancy more than I was aware of before. For so many girls and young women, they started taking hormonal contraceptives in their teens, late teens. So even then, by the time they're coming to start a family, you know, they've maybe been on them for 15 plus years. They've never really understood what their own cycle is. So they've never come to terms or had an awareness of their own fertility or biology because they've been on the pill for so long. So what is a normal for them monthly cycle? What is my fertility? How do I feel off it? I can't actually remember. So it's a very different landscape to when it was first introduced. When it did, it was ushered in with celebration and congratulations for this freedom that was promised. So again, it's not a sense of judgment, but it is just we're in a different space now.
So one of the things which we found very remarkable and interesting is a paper which was published just in early 25, so very recently published, by a group of researchers, some of whom worked for British Pregnancy Advisory Service, some of whom were academics. But what they did is that they analysed the use of contraceptives in people who were presenting for abortion. And they compared it with a period in 2018 compared with a period in 2023. We'll put the link in the show notes. This paper is freely available for download. And what they demonstrated was that between 2018 and 2023, the figures had significantly moved against hormonal contraception. So that in 2023, only 11% of people who presented were using a hormonal contraceptive method. 16% were using some other method, presumably barrier methods. 2.5% were using so-called fertility awareness-based methods, which is largely smartphone apps, isn't it? And then nearly 70% were said they were using no contraception at all. And if the public health perspective of this is quite interesting because public health doctors have always assumed that the principal problems in fertility is lack of education, lack of sex education, and lack of accessibility of contraceptives and contraceptive advice. And therefore, the assumption is once you give universal sex education and you make contraceptions freely available, well, of course, every sensible person who doesn't want to have a baby is going to be using an effective contraceptive method. And so it's mind-boggling to me that 70%, and these are very large numbers, this is out of a total of 55,000 women, 70% said they were not using any form of contraception at all. And incidentally, it does fit with my wife, Celia, as you know, Dawn, has worked as a crisis pregnancy counsellor for many years. And she has recounted to me the number of women who've discovered they were pregnant, single women, who said, I've been sleeping with my boyfriend on and off, you know, for some time. But I never crossed my mind that I could possibly get pregnant. I mean, and they are genuinely shocked by the discovery that they were pregnant, even though they were not using any particular contraceptive method.
I want to make really clear, I am no expert here, but certainly in the context of the idea that more information and education is a good thing, I suppose you have to think about, well, what's the message that you're presenting behind that? And so often what we would see and what I feel is happening is that sex is being treated as a toy and it's being separated out from the natural consequences of sex, which is pregnancy. So to some degree, we have access to more information than we've ever had. But I think the level of understanding of how our bodies work, how many days in the month we can get pregnant, what pregnancy is, what contraceptives do, that has all become very muddied. So there's a general sense of sex education, but it's become separated from biology. And I think it's become separated from relationships. So certainly, even just looking at my own three daughters, the sex education they received in school was really very basic at core. Some external providers were brought in where relationships maybe were better talked about. But generally speaking, I don't think it's particularly good in the UK. There are some better examples than others. But when it comes to sort of older women, I do wonder now with the rise in the interest of fertility awareness, if it all just feeds back into, do you know, we were given basics of information, but I want to understand better how this all works. When it comes to the women in the study that we're talking about who have presented for abortion, it's a particular, I suppose, cohort, which isn't representative of the population as a whole. But it does, I think, for me, it comes back to we need to understand fertility in the context of how our bodies work, the natural consequences of sex, what pregnancy is, how pregnancy is prevented, how pregnancy is terminated, what abortion is and does, what contraceptives are and do, and bring that all together in the context of relationships. And of course, in the modern era, the language of choice and consent, what that looks like in the context of responsibility and men and women and relationships. I think it's all just become really muddied. And certainly as church, I think we need to do a lot better because we have a better story about God's order, God's design, and God's plan for each and every one of his image bearers.
It's really interesting what you mentioned there, Dawn, about people kind of failing to join the dots and having this sense that sex is completely detached from reproduction now. And I wonder if there's actually an ironic paradox, which is that the introduction of the pill two generations or whatever it was ago did create this distinction, which has never really existed in human history before, where for most people, if most women are on the pill, then a lot of the people can have sex for decades and have no fear of becoming pregnant if they use it properly. And so then the culture shifts and the two things become separated. And then people start to think, well, why do I need to have contraception then? Because, you know, sex is not about people have kids when they're married and they choose to. But if I'm in my early 20s and just having an ordinary life with my partners, I don't need to think about it. So they come off the pill and then suddenly birth rates start to rise or whatever, or abortion rates start to rise because people have almost lost that fundamental connection almost because of the pill. They've lost that connection between having sex and having children.
Yeah. And there's also been, you know, an intentional messaging from certain quarters that, you know, when does pregnancy start? And actually, for example, emergency contraception is just bringing on a late period or a missed period. And even actually early medical abortion is bringing on a missed period. So again, I think there's this sort of blurring intentionally of the lines, you know, what's a contraceptive, what's a contragestive, what's an abortificant, what is pregnancy, when does life begin? It all becomes just a bit muddy. People can then willfully choose to be ignorant, you know, and it all feeds into the conversation that we're having.
It's interesting, isn't it, too, that, you know, there's been a very major campaign by the abortion charities, the pro-abortion charities, to make abortion as simple. The narrative is we're removing barriers. You know, in the bad old days, there were all these barriers. It was very hard to get an abortion and all the rest. Now all you need to do is in the privacy of your home, dial a number, have a short conversation with someone on the other end of the phone, receive some tablets, do it all at home. Nobody need ever know. It's so easy, so straightforward. That's the narrative, isn't it? And so if I think of that narrative, then I compare it with, you know, taking decades of hormones, filling my body with decades of hormones, then you could see that it shifts. Well, you know, we'll try not to get pregnant. And if it happens, well, we've always got an easy solution.
And in the context of, you know, maybe having questions now about hormones being taken for decades and not understanding how your own body works, so you just stop taking anything, but you've always then got access to emergency contraceptives, you know, that just, as I said, bring on a missed period, or early medical abortion, which has really been demedicalized. You know, we've taken it outside of medical oversight. So many safeguards have been removed. The access to information is on the internet, but you don't necessarily have to look into the what's and the how's, because you just make a phone call, it gets posted out. You can be as ignorant as you choose to be, never mind the fact that, you know, there's the element of coercion, and that somebody can request the pill that's not the person that's going to be taking it, and they might not even know, you know, they might be given it, you know, which has hit the headlines, you know. So I think it's back to, I would love to see a conversation. I think we need more research into fertility awareness methods. There needs to be more sort of support for it, I think, within the medical profession, or an increased understanding of it. But also just, I think, as women, we need to take responsibility for our own decision making. But that means having access to the best information. And we need to be intentional about that. We can't just leave it up to other people to give us.
So, Dawn, you are very... honestly talked about your own experience, and I wonder if I can, just sparing the blushes too much, you know, ask you about the practicalities of what, you know, was previously called the rhythm method. You know, how did you were faced with this prospect of using this method because you already had three children. What were the practicalities before the internet, before, you know, the modern smartphone apps were available? You know, how did you find that? How intrusive was it in terms of your life? What's your experience over doing this for quite a long time?
Well, so I misinformed you. So I didn't ever actually do it properly. I had one friend who was American who talked about having received some information, I think from a nun at the time. I remember sort of rolling my eyes and, you know, having a bit of a giggle about it. But I had my three girls all quite close, and between breastfeeding and then sort of just when it happened, I didn't ever actually intentionally use natural family planning or fertility awareness methods. But when we knew that we had completed our family, and as I said, we were young, then we had the conversation about, well, what do we do now for the next 30 odd years? And back to actually where sort of Tim at the start said about, you know, men engaging in the conversation too. I was just talking with my husband a couple of days ago, you know, and sort of reminding him that actually he had been the one that was probably more against 30 years worth of hormones being taken. So he initiated the conversation. He was like, well, do you know, it's a long time to be taking artificial hormones. And because I had such a strong sense of the value of life, but also we felt we completed our family, and abortion was never going to be an option, then actually sterilization would probably be sort of the decision to take. But again, he said, and he's not here, so we'll spare his blushes easily. He said it would be a more difficult procedure for me. So he said he would have a vasectomy. So that was our solution to avoid me taking contraceptives that we were concerned wouldn't sort of be conducive with health long term, other contraceptives that I didn't agree with on an ethical basis. So it was a joint decision, and probably because I didn't understand fertility awareness methods. And like I said, there was a bit of eye rolling. And it's only now, looking back, there's been such a development. I think a couple of years, it was probably during COVID, actually, I joined a webinar that was based in Manhattan, in a women's health clinic in Manhattan. And they had one of the creators of the of a certain fertility app, and she's a scientist, she and her husband, and it was based basically similar decision making to my own. They didn't want to be taking as a couple hormones for years, and they wanted to be more healthy in the context of holistic health. So they developed an app, and it was the first one I think that the FDA had given approval to. And my ears pricked up because I was thinking, well, this is fascinating. We now have technology to help women, you know, monitor, understand their cycle, do all of the other sort of checks that maybe apps can help with. And it was a really interesting discussion in the context of the bigger conversation about all of the choices. And I remember thinking, this is brilliant. You know, this is the sort of conversation that we need to be having with younger women.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Because we mentioned these apps, didn't we, in our previous conversation? And, you know, for those who aren't aware, you know, if I mean, I'm going to brutally summarize and get some of the stuff wrong, but basically it helps women understand their own cycle, and then that they can tell them there are days in which it is risky to have sex if you're trying to avoid pregnancy, and there are days in which it's safer to have sex. And it, you know, it's a kind of 21st century update of what is sometimes being called the rhythm method, which excuse me, women have kind of pursued for millennia, I imagine, which is again trying to understand when they're ovulating, and so when is higher likelihood or less likelihood to have sex. But there are claims that with the apps able to track it more closely, you can get kind of upwards of 95%+ kind of success rates, which would be kind of comparable with the pill and other hormonal contraceptions. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary. And sort of the rhythm method, I suppose if we make clear, we're not talking about it's rhythm in the sense of calendar.
Yes.
I think that's a really good example. I, for example, after having four pregnancies and three babies, I did not know there were actually only maybe 5 or 6 days a month I could get pregnant. That was like, oh, I didn't, like 20 mm-hmm. years later, how did I not know that? You know, there's this sense that any time in a month that you have sex, you could get pregnant. You know, so this is where the information comes from. And of course, taking artificial hormones, you don't need to know that, because everything's very tightly controlled. And then I think you have a sense of, I can control this. And of course, every method, you know, there are sort of possibilities that you're not in control. So yes, you're aware of your own cycle, you're checking your basal body temperature, and you're checking also sort of discharge, you know, that then would inhibit or not inhibit sperm and egg mating. And in the context of understanding your body, then, as you say, you can figure out at what point in the month you're least likely, or it's nearly impossible to get pregnant, or most likely. So you're either preventing pregnancy or planning pregnancy, and you can be aided in that. You can then, when you're most at risk, you either abstain from sex or you use a barrier method. Do you know? So it's not about, I think it's powerful in recognizing how the body works and working with it as opposed to working against it.
But I could definitely, you know, see the logic in that, both from a biological point of view and also from a Christian theological point of view. And it is interesting that it's not solely about contraception, is it? I mean, it's also, the idea is that for those couples who are desperately trying to conceive, this is a way of maximizing the possibility of natural fertility. And I think, again, that's a very positive approach, you know, working with the body, understanding the body.
Mm-hmm.
But
doing it together.
And doing it together. Yeah, no, it's very interesting mm-hmm. that you emphasize that, because that is, is the complete 180 degrees from the way that the contraceptive pill was.
So one of my best friends, who's also a colleague in both lives, and she's Catholic, so she has four daughters, where I have three, and she would make use of fertility awareness, and talking about it, I suppose, back to sort of our resentment of our fertility and biology. If I'm really sort of blunt, when I was younger, I think I started my monthly cycle, I started menstruating when I was 11. I was horrified, angry, hated it, and grew up denying hormones, didn't want to talk about it, resenting it, just the whole thing. And then somehow, yes, magically or not, just got on with life. She, as I have got to know her better, and we laugh about it all the time, where I resent and ignore hormones, she's much more aware of her cycle. She talks about the times in the month that are more conducive to productivity and not. I argue with her, you know, well, that's ridiculous, because, you know, women just need to get on with life, and you need to, whatever stage of your cycle you're at. So it's this sort of tussle with, you know, our own nature. And I suppose it's just that desire to work with it. And then in the context of a couple, be talking to one another about it, and just how much more healthy that is than forcing our bodies to do something that actually that is against what they were designed to do. And also then in taking the pill, we don't understand our own cycle, but B, we have no need to talk to our partner about it, because we don't need to collectively work on it, you know, on either preventing or getting pregnant in that way. So I just, I think we're in a different era of interest. I think there's a lot more research to be done. And in the context of choice, it's not a matter, I'm not sort of sitting here saying I know the decisions that I made. But in the context of choice, I think there's the need for more information, more research, more information, and then laying it all out so that women can make the best decision for them in their context with their family.
When we talked about the fertility-based awareness methods, the apps, rhythm method, whatever language we want to use, I think it's fair to say in our original conversation, we were a little dismissive at times, or at least we kind of questioned some of the aspects of it. So there's a kind of common quip, isn't there, that what do you call a couple who are using the rhythm method? Parents. And there's this idea that it kind of doesn't really work, and if you do it long enough, you know, it will break down. Let's start with that one. Do you think that's fair? Do you think actually, because, you know, I've read that, you know, it can be up to 95%+, but that's if women are very fastidious about taking basal temperatures and measuring cervical mucus and all this other stuff, and every day going to the app and logging an array of symptoms. Most people have busy, complicated lives, and they might find it difficult to kind of follow the apps to their absolute peak. Do you think it's fair to say that actually, if these apps continue rising, more women will start using them who don't have the kind of discipline to use them properly, and so therefore their effectiveness will gradually slide?
I do think it's fascinating. You know, we can be disciplined in so many areas, you know, when it's something that we really want to achieve, you know, or avoid, actually. When it comes to fertility and pregnancy and having children, it's probably one of the most life-changing things that can happen to any woman or couple. So why we wouldn't want to take responsibility for that, or find the easy way out, I think we absolutely should hold ourselves to a higher bar, especially if we want to be healthy and well when we're living longer. You know, we take all of that into account. Technology absolutely can help. Talking to sort of the women that I have been in the last sort of couple of months, sort of finding out, as I said, anecdotally, how they have found it. Once they've got into the way of it, you know, it's not onerous. Now it does depend on the state of your health initially. So if you don't have regular cycles, you know, so you do need to be aware. This isn't a matter of potluck, you know, cross your fingers and enter into this natural method. I think it's really unhelpful even to think about it that way. It's fertility awareness based methods. I think once we think it's about information and then about making decisions based on that information, as opposed to, I heard somebody the other day talk about, you know, well, just be natural and let nature take its course. I'm like, what does that even mean? That, you know, it's not about that. It's not about sort of influencers and social media who've thrown their hormonal pills down the toilet, you know, flushed the loo and said, we're just going to be natural. Do you know, there are people who have done the research. They are looking at the science of it. Do you know, so it does take effort. But I think, one, if you want to be healthy. Two, if you want to think about a long-term method that won't that will support the healthy lifestyle that you want to lead. And three, whenever you additionally or have a strong understanding of when life begins, for me, it ticks all those boxes.
It's interesting that... you know, going back to secular attitudes, certainly within the public health medical sphere, this is the dominant view is that sex is a recreational activity. You know, a bit like football or, you know, climbing mountains or
watching TV,
whatever your thing is, and you know, lots of human beings like to engage in this recreational activity, and the goal of science and society is to make this as simple, safe, and available as possible. I've often thought that really conflicts with this idea, oh, well, pregnancy, now that's a very serious thing. Now you've really got to be very responsible and you've got to make sure you take your hormones, you've got to have regular antenatal checkups, you've got to have all the scans, you know, you need all this information. So it's this kind of paradox that in secular ideas we want just all the fun and recreation of sex, which is cut free from reproduction. And I think the inevitable consequence of what you are promoting and discussing and is that it turns sex back to be a much more thoughtful, you know, considered, mutual, serious activity. Yes, of course, it is fun and pleasure and all the rest, but there is this underlying moral seriousness about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I get that maybe for people who have different values in a secular world, you wouldn't be starting in the same place that I'm starting. Where I believe, and actually as part of our work and as part of our conversation with the church, talking about when life begins and the ethics of life before birth and life post-birth and how it ends, actually the story of the incarnation of Jesus has become foundational and formational. And if we agree or believe with scripture that says that the word became flesh at conception, then from a Christian, an Orthodox Christian perspective, human dignity, we are made in the image of God from the point of conception. And because that's when God himself chose to join us in the womb of his mother, biologically related to her, with all of the beautiful relational context of pregnancy. So God's heart for both lives and pregnancy is modeled through his own unborn story. Joseph is then asked to come into that story as the earthly father of God the Son. So I think as church, as Christians, we have the most beautiful life-giving pregnancy story ever told that continues to the spiritual life, new birth that we are promised. So as a Christian, I believe that life begins at conception, modeled and underscored by God's joining us at that point. That then challenges me to think about how I apply that to my personal life, but also in my conversations with other people, with my daughters and others. So there has to be a consistency in my thinking, in my theology, and in my life decisions. I think too many people, church and non-churched, there isn't a consistency. We don't have consistency in the information we're given medically or scientifically. Actually, just recently, we were participating in the law review in Scotland. Scotland are reviewing their own abortion law. And it was fascinating looking at the NHS websites. So on one NHS website talking about pregnancy and second trimester pregnancy and talking about potentially second trimester miscarriage, the language was baby, you'll suffer labour pains, you'll give birth. We will treat the baby with respect and dispose of the fetal remains according to your desires. So that was all second trimester pregnancy loss, spontaneous pregnancy loss. But on another NHS website or web page talking about second trimester abortion, it's bringing on a missed period. You might suffer some pain. There might be a bit more bleeding than a normal period. Take some medication. You know, so I think it was a perfect example of the intentional sort of blurring of lines, the misinformation that women are receiving or can understand or can't understand. And that leads then to the decisions that we make. You know, what is sex? What is pregnancy? What is life before birth? And certainly we all deserve to have consistency in our understanding and thinking. And as Christians, it's the same. And when we have a very clear and consistent understanding of when life begins, then every decision that we make about pregnancy, birth, then follows on from that.
Yeah, fascinating. It's I mean, something we've certainly talked about before is this complete disconnect within the NHS. You know, the paradox is, if you were to challenge, as I have done, NHS staff about this, they would say, we're just being sensitive. We're just being empathic. We're, you know, some people have this view that the baby is incredibly precious right from a few gestations. Other people see it as unwanted tissue that they're getting rid of. And our role is just to be sensitive and adapt our counselling and our language to whatever the client wants. But, I mean, you argue yourself into this cloud cuckoo land where the value of this being depends on what the mum thinks of it.
Yeah, and that same woman can have two very different experiences. And if a termination comes before subsequent pregnancy, and, you know, some women have shared their own stories with us, you know, that very idea of, well, over here I was told I was only given the information I asked for, and maybe I purposely didn't go seeking it, but I believed it's not a baby yet. And then with a subsequent pregnancy, I understood what I had done, you know, however many years before, and it led to more pain than maybe had been expected. Do you know? So I don't want to paint everybody in the NHS as being willfully misleading and giving misinformation, but on the surface of it, you know, scientifically, it's the same. So the same stuff is happening in your body, but the language and the messaging and the picture that's being painted is so different that the dots aren't being connected purposely, maybe out of a sense of compassion, but then it can lead to women on the ground actually being misled, and actually it's not helpful in the context of decision making.
And to draw it back to contraception for a second, I think there's something to be said for this disconnect is probably only possible in a contraceptive era when not only is abortion, you know, freely available up to 24 weeks, but also people have sex thousands of times without any sense that they might be opening the possibility to pregnancy. And so, you know, you could make the case potentially that a turn away from hormonal contraception back towards rhythm-based methods and fertility-based awareness methods and apps and things, even if it might not be as robustly successful in terms of a percentage, it actually is helpful at breaking down this division we have between, you know, the sex that you have for recreational purposes and the sex that you have to have a child. Because we might say, really, we're talking about percentage chances here. And so, you know, when you're on the app, it quite helpfully might say, you know what, today is a low risk, but it's not 0%. There's no day in which you can be absolutely certain that it's impossible for you to get pregnant. And conversely, there's no day when it's 100% guaranteed if you have sex today, you're going to become pregnant. And actually, that helps us understand that these two things cannot be separated. They are always enmeshed. And you can do things, whether it's take the pill or whether it's measure your basal temperature, that can give you more information to make an informed choice. But ultimately, the biological reality remains the case. If you have sex, there is a small chance that you may fall pregnant.
Yeah, you can disguise it, you can hide it, you can deny it, but it's still the case that that's how life is created. That's a natural consequence of sex. That's how your body works. And I think it's wrong to hide that. I also think that the messaging around control, you know, ultimately we're led to believe we can control our own bodies, we can control pregnancy, and nothing is 100% controllable unless you don't have sex. So again, it's not helpful to think about it in the context of control, you know, and if you do then somehow get pregnant, you can control whether or not you continue in the pregnancy, and you can control when you choose to become pregnant again. And of course, all of that I would question. You know, there's one woman shared her story with us. You know, she had a termination in, she was actually the same age as me when we had our pregnancy crises. We were both 21. She, you know, was advised, it's not the right time, you know, have a termination. It's not a baby yet anyway. You can get pregnant at another time. And she never got pregnant again. Do you know, so that idea of control and choice, I think ultimately we need to question anyway. So yes, back to contraceptives and controlling our own actions and the outcomes of our actions. I think maybe the focus needs to be on controlling ourselves as opposed to controlling sort of the outcome that ultimately we can't.
And just before we finish, let's put you on the spot here, Dawn. Imagine a young woman, a young Christian woman approaches you and says, you know, I am recently married. I'd like to have children at some point in the future, but not right now. I'm feeling very conflicted about the various options. Would you advise them to steer away from hormonal contraception and towards fertility-based awareness now? Do you feel like it's the right choice for most people?
I would be very cautious. What I would advise them to do is go speak to someone. So I've been talking recently with two doctors. One works in the sexual health end, another is a GP who's also trained in fertility awareness methods. Do you know, so I would certainly be more than happy to counsel with a small C in quotes, you know, as a friend. And what I would advocate for is getting all of the information, and I'd certainly then be happy to sit with them as they go through it. But I wouldn't be the one telling them what to do. What I would advocate for is give us the information. Where there are gaps in information, do you know what? Let's do more research. Let's look longer term. Let's do the big scale longitudinal studies. You know, let's talk about it all. Absolutely. Put everything out on the table and let's have the conversation. And I'd like to be part of the conversation. But yes, I wouldn't be telling anybody what to do.
And just one other thing before we let you go. You've mentioned a few times about how your belief in life beginning at conception made certain contraceptive options kind of unavailable to you. Could you explain a little bit more about that? Because I think a lot of Christians might never have come across this idea before, and they might be thinking to themselves, well, hang on, I thought the pill just stopped me ovulating. How can this conflict with my beliefs about life beginning? Could you just explain a bit about your thinking there?
So for me, my understanding is, you know, that life begins at conception. So preventing conception is where I would enter into and then draw the line. Once conception has happened, I wouldn't willingly or intentionally take anything that prevents implantation. And then certainly once there has been implantation, I wouldn't willingly or intentionally expel the embryo that has become implanted. So a contraceptive that prevents fertilization, I would have been happy with. Something that maybe prevented fertilization, but also maybe prevented implantation, then that's where I drew the line. And that was the conversation that I had with the healthcare professional who was advocating for, I think it was the coil. And I was like, no, that wouldn't be something that I would be willing to use. But again, in having conversations with other women, I don't know why I had such a strong sense of what I agreed with and what I didn't. So many women never asked the questions and probably didn't read the literature. And I'm not blaming anybody for that. I just wonder why I was so interested in it. So it's not a sense of and as I said, then having those conversations, people can maybe feel guilty or question maybe a method of contraception that they have been using maybe for years and didn't know how it worked. And then now that they know how it works, maybe would think differently. That's okay. You know, that's where mercy and, you know, everything comes in. It's not a matter of judgment. It's just a matter of information.
Hmm. And so I guess for those who aren't aware, because I think some people might become familiar, at least when growing up, I was aware that, you know, lots of Christians, evangelicals, would be uncomfortable with things like the morning after pill, because it has this kind of potential dual effect. It can prevent fertilization, but if fertilization has happened, it also prevents implantation. But a lot of people might not realize that's true of other forms of contraception. So you're saying that the coil, it doesn't just make it harder for sperm to reach the egg, but it also makes it harder for a fertilized egg to be implanted when it comes down the fallopian tubes.
Yeah, and in the name of informed decision making, we just need the information.
Yeah,
do you know?
Because people just don't talk about that very much, do they?
No. And you're maybe not given the information if you don't ask for it. Do you know? So I think we have a responsibility in line with our conscience, with our value base, to get the information and then make the decision based on that. And obviously then the wider conversation about longer term, you know, over decades of use, understanding what that does to our bodies, that all plays into it. Yeah.
Because there's so many levels here, aren't there? Because as you say, there's the, if you believe life begins at conception, then you might have ethical concerns, but then there's also the kind of health concerns about, as you say, long-term use. And then there's a kind of theological question I've seen some people say about, you know, do we want to be cutting against the grain of the way our bodies were made? And, you know, is it healthy and appropriate for us as kind of creatures to rail against the creator's design, the creator's order? And maybe, you know, I've seen some theologians suggest that, you know, God set up human fertility to work so that three weeks out in a month, it's quite hard to get pregnant. And the fourth week is maybe a time for couples to kind of be chaste and abstain from sex. And that would be normal for previous generations, but it's kind of people find that intolerable idea today. So there's lots of different levels of contraception, which we can't dig into, obviously. I think we should probably come to a close there. But thanks so much, Dawn, for opening up some of those big themes and pushing back on some of our own conversation. It's been really helpful talking about this with you. So thanks for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
We'll try and put some links to the things we talked about. So particularly that study Dad mentioned at the start about the rise in people who are on no contraception at all and the increase in people using fertility apps. and also our link to a previous conversation if you didn't catch that on contraception is worth listening to. Dawn, if people want to find out more about Both Lives, what should they do?
They can find us on bothlives.co.uk. We're on Facebook, Instagram and X, not on TikTok and probably never will be. But yeah, we would love people to get in touch with us. And undoubtedly, a bit like I did with you, John, if anybody and Tim, if anybody disagrees with anything that I've said, I would be more than happy for them to push back. This is all about dialogue and where we might disagree, but that's okay. We'll disagree well.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thanks very much, Dawn. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And as Dawn said, we would really be interested to hear your own thoughts, particularly if you disagree with anything anyone has said, you want to push back, you want to offer up another perspective, please do get in touch with us. Or if you have suggestions for things that we haven't talked about yet on the podcast, but you think we should, please do email us molad@premier.org.uk. You can go to Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, for lots more resources, particularly around medical ethics, stuff at the start of life. All that jazz, johnwyatt.com, and you can find out some of my journalism at tswyatt.com. And in particular, why not sign up for my weekly Substack Church News newsletter, The Critical Friend?
I will.
Also available. Thanks, Dawn. That's all for now. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week with another episode. But until then, bye bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.